Welcome to the Clarity Fund Podcast. I'm Dr. Owen Anderson, and if you're joining me, it's because you like philosophy. You like to ask basic questions, like, how do we know things? Many people have opinions, but you wonder, how can we actually know which one is true? And what is real? Many people have different beliefs about how the world is formed, what it's like. How can we know, and which one of those is correct? What actually is real? And what is good? There are all kinds of conflicts in the world about values. What actually is valuable? And is there a highest value? So we explore these questions in our podcast, and the last few weeks I've been talking about anxiety and reason. I'm continuing on that today. I'm going to look at a specific thinker now, Kierkegaard, Soren Kierkegaard, and some of what he had to say about anxiety, or sometimes it's translated dread, and his book is looked at as a study of the idea of dread, the concept of dread, and also his book, Sickness Unto Death. We're going to look at how he understands modernity and the creation of the idea of anxiety. One thing to notice that I find it interesting is that the concept of anxiety, the study of anxiety as an object, really becomes a topic in the 19th century. So thinkers like Kierkegaard, there are thinkers who maybe exhibit similar types of things that we would now call anxiety. But here it is, it's a focus now, a topic that's studied. What is it? And is it something unique to the modern person? Now, there's been ways in which I've argued it isn't. There's a sense of anxiety that comes from a living, and the idea of death is prominent. Death as the ultimate challenge or threat to the self, and the unknown, not knowing what death represents or what happens to the self. Is it the end of the self? And so we've talked about it that way, and that's certainly not new to modernity, but some of the thinkers we're going to look at, beginning with Kierkegaard, study something that seems to be unique. There's a kind of problem that's been set up in the modern world, and that problem creates, we're going to diagnose it. Last time we talked about how it has to do with a limited view of reason and how this shapes the self and the goals of the self. Our understanding of the self. So we're going to look at that and see, what is that view of reason? How does that create a problem for integration? We have conflicts within us because of that, and we're not able to integrate these. We live with those conflicts, which creates that existential anxiety about our condition, and we have to repress one, not think about one, in order to keep going. That creates that background of anxiety. And it's a failure to have integrity. The demand for integrity, and then coupled with the failure to have integrity, produces that anxiety. And in that way, the anxiety is a kind of inner reminder of our need for integrity. So we coupled it in the first podcast in this series on anxiety. We coupled it with the age of skepticism. Anxiety as the inner life of an age of skepticism. And we'll see Kierkegaard saying some similar things, but also some dissimilar things. He especially thinks about it in a few ways that I want to look at now. The growth of the individual's consciousness. Now, he takes the story in the Garden of Eden as a myth representing that growth. Setting aside or even saying the historicity of it is irrelevant, what's important is the story as allegory. So right there, he's already put himself in a line of thought about the historicity of it and how that affects his view of what is real and how God is known. So just making note of that, now let's turn and see, what does he think the allegory is about? Well, it's about the growth of consciousness as we come to a greater understanding of good and evil. The myth represents as outward that which occurred inwardly. So putting an outward story, don't eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. is really a story about what happened internally and what happens for each one of us internally. And so far, I think, sure, that could be fine. Each one of us may recapitulate that original sin, while it also is historical. But here he's taking it and saying, no, let's take it just as a story that represents outwardly what occurred inwardly. And the individual's inner awakening to self-consciousness, a growth in self-consciousness. So that at some point there occurs a knowledge of good and evil, as the story puts it. One goes from not knowing what they are to knowing what they are, and that growth in consciousness produces anxiety. Why? Well, we move from, there's a change, and he talks sometimes about it as a creative change. And when we have, anytime we have a creative change, we go from what is known and comfortable to what is unknown with new horizons opened up. So in this case, good and evil. Now let's compare that to what the text actually says about Adam and Eve. Is this a picture of growth? And I want to just mention as we're going that other thinkers will take this same idea, that it's an allegory and it's a growth in consciousness, and point out that it's a good thing. Adam and Eve needed to go through this in order to grow more in their knowledge, more in their understanding. And it was wrong for them to be told not to do it. That was a kind of hindrance presented to them. So we'll see other thinkers who also look at anxiety, like Freud and Jung, speak about the story that way. This is growing up. This is maturing. You go from innocence, where you're not aware of good and evil, to maturity, where you're aware of good and evil, and it presents anxiety for you, because you suddenly become aware of these new dimensions of the world and your lack of control over them, and the uncertainty about what will happen to you or what you'll be able to achieve. All right, so now back to Kierkegaard. So the central problem for Kierkegaard is how the individual can will to be himself. That is our true vocation, our true calling. How can you will to be yourself? And you cannot define this self apart from freedom. The self is freedom, the freedom of choice. And you have to be willing to take that step, that leap of freedom. But people avoid that because of the unknown. And so they avoid willing to be themselves. They avoid consciousness by the self. And they will to be someone else, say a construct made by society or someone who's acceptable to their family, or they will themselves defiantly to be against what other people want, or they might form a kind of stoic willing, recognizing that you're doomed to fall short in a fatalistic way. Now, the word will there is not the same as voluntarism, which speaks about the will, and the 19th century sometimes speaks of the will as what needs to have power. So, for example, willpower. That is, in two areas that are common in the literature, anger and lust. And the will knows those are wrong, knows those are hurtful. That's where the voluntarism comes in. You know you shouldn't be angry or you shouldn't lust. Society puts those demands on you, and so you have to have willpower. And if you fail, if you give in to one of those, it's a failure of the will, a weakness of your will, because your mind knew they're wrong. So we're going to come back to that in a minute. But the will there, in other words, is active in repressing anger and lust, which will be an important theme then for 20th century psychoanalytic theory and trying to bring to consciousness what's been repressed by the will. So Kierkegaard here, though, is speaking about consciousness of the self. The more conscious you are, the more you are yourself. And so you're freely choosing to be yourself by removing any of the blockages, any inner self-defeating conflicts that exist. because the individual has been forced to block them. You're removing those, you're becoming aware. And so freedom occurs not just like how a plant grows towards the sun, just sort of unconscious. Instead, it depends on how one relates oneself at every moment to existence. So it's very conscious, not unconscious. This means that in the present day, freedom depends on how responsibly and autonomously one relates to oneself. And for many modern thinkers, including Marx and Freud, this sets up the problem of the modern self, which is the modern self, on the one hand, by industry, by labor, is made to become an automaton, alienated from the self. On the other hand, the self, the modern self, has more access to awareness and consciousness. And that creates for them their inner tension. But let's go back to what Kierkegaard said here about freedom for us, because we're going to think about it differently than that. It depends on how one relates oneself at every moment in existence and to existence. That's the integration part. All right. Now, using that, going back to both the Garden of Eden story and also to the problem of voluntarism. Adam and Eve are told not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. For the day they eat, they will surely die. Now a tempter comes, the serpent. And he presents the opposite. He contradicts what God said. You will not surely die. And he gives an argument to support that conclusion. The argument is, you will be as God, knowing good and evil the way God does. And since you'll be as God, you won't die. God doesn't die. So here's an argument from the serpent, and it's testing what Adam and Eve knew about God. Now, how would they have known this? They didn't have the Bible. Well, it's testing what they would have known from general revelation, what they both would have known and could have known. They both could have known that they, as creatures, couldn't be as God. God alone is eternal. That is a fundamental feature of the nature of God. God is without beginning. And Adam and Eve both had a beginning. And you can't go from having had a beginning to not having a beginning. So they are fundamentally different than God in that respect. And they couldn't ever become God. And that's knowable from general revelation. It took me maybe 30 seconds to review it with you. So they could have known that. Indeed, what Adam was doing right before this event was Adam was naming the creatures, which shows Adam as a user of reason. He's seeing the nature of each creature and naming it to distinguish it from other creatures. So when you name, for example, the dog and you name the cat, you're seeing the difference between them. Dogs aren't cats, and cats aren't dogs. Rhinoceros, giraffe, alligator, etc. So Adam is using reason to form concepts, and those concepts would have included God and man. He's just shown he could use reason, and then he's tested on his ability to use reason. And Eve is in the same situation. So the tempter is very cunning, wily, and he asks just the right question to test if they've been using reason as they should have to know God, to know the distinction between God and man. And what it says is that Eve saw that the fruit was pleasing to the eye. It's interesting that that matters. It looks good, and it is good for gaining wisdom. So she was told, and she believed it. So she ate some, and she gave some to Adam. And they immediately felt shame. So is this a story of going of a positive development in their life, in the life of humanity, of going from not having felt shame, we'll call it innocence, to feeling shame? Well, the way that Kierkegaard presents it, and others have done this too, is that this is growing in the knowledge of good and evil. Now, that isn't at all what they were tempted with. It wasn't the knowledge of good and evil simpliciter. It was knowing good and evil the way God does. Adam and Eve could already have, and have demonstrated they did, know the difference between good and evil. And here's how they would know that. Two things. Adam, in naming the creatures, demonstrated that he understood that things have natures. And an evil act is an act contrary to the nature of a being, and a good act is an act consistent with the nature of a being. So Adam would have shown, he did show, that he understands that things have natures and can be named. So he understood good and evil. And then the very fact that they're given a command. If you command something to, if you give a command to something that can't understand good and evil, then you can't expect them to keep the command, and you couldn't punish them for not keeping the command. So no, that's not what it means. It's not knowing good and evil simpliciter. It's knowing good and evil the way God does. And God knows good and evil eternally as the creator. By giving things natures, he's determining what is good and evil for them. And that's different from humans who discover human discover good and evil by discovering the nature of things. And so, continuing with that basic distinction between God and man, that only God is eternal, that also affects the way that God knows good and evil and the way humans know good and evil. And so this isn't a positive development of growth and consciousness. Shame relates to what we're studying right now in anxiety by being a product of the failure to have integrity. And they realized they didn't have integrity. Now, it's interesting that it especially says they recognize they were naked. And you might wonder, why that? Why not something else? And what did their nakedness have to do with them not having known what they should? Were they somehow preoccupied with that aspect of human nature, and they hadn't fulfilled their duty of knowing God? But what stands out is what they tried to do. What they immediately tried to do is, and what they did, is cover themselves. They cover up the problem. Now, that doesn't really solve anything. Putting on fig leaves doesn't solve the problem that you violated this command. And who could possibly think it would? But that's a common behavior of humans. And so in that respect, we can say Kierkegaard was right to say this represents something humans go through. That immediately feeling of shame and then covering it up, that's what the word is used sometimes, repression. We want to be careful there not to use it in ways not intended. But instead of solving the problem, and how would they solve it? What would integrity require? Well, integrity would require addressing it head on. Confessing to God. That would be the act of integrity and not dividing the self. But instead, the self is divided, and they cover themselves. That's the repressing, not paying attention to, trying to keep it under, not seen, not dealt with in the open. And then that leads to the next problem, which is when they're asked about it by God, again, they have an opportunity to repent and say, you know what, we did what we were told not to, and then on top of that, we tried to cover it up. They could have done that. That would be what integrity requires, but they didn't do that. Instead, they then blame someone else. So they've covered themselves up, and then they blame another, which is a further act of protecting their lack of integrity. So they've had two opportunities. We call them two calls back. The inner call of shame to repent, and then the outer call of a question. Where are you? What have you done? That's a question for them, not that God is seeking information, but a question for them, an opportunity for them to repent. And they don't take either one. Now, interestingly, in the text, that's when natural evil befalls the world, culminating especially in death, pronounced on Adam for all, from dust you came, and to dust you shall return. And in the first in this series, talking about anxiety, I noted how death is especially anxiety-producing for most, and the way that people get around it is by not thinking about it. You can go quite a long time without thinking about it. But death is there, just like that inner call of shame and that outer question, as a call back to stop and think about your condition. What have you done? It's a call to have integrity. And there are many ways in which people try to either not think about death or downplay it to take away its effect as a call back to have integrity. So either by not thinking about it on the one hand, or when you do think about it, you think of it as, say, release into a spiritual realm where you'll be happier, you're freed from the body. So you try to make it sound like a positive thing instead of ultimately, no, it is something that was introduced after the original creation and as a call to stop and think. Now that is the anxiety-producing part, even though it need not produce anxiety. The anxiety comes from having tried to repress it, not think about it, but it's still there. That's what causes the subjective, existential anxiety then. And it's relieved only by having integrity, a concern for consistency. And so psychologists like Freud will use that term to be integrated into one's environment. And coming back now, as we're wrapping up to Kierkegaard, he brought that up as well. Relating to your environment, relating to existence. Well, in order to do that, you need to know what exists. And if you don't know what exists, you're not able to relate to it. Presumably, we agree there are no unicorns, and so we don't spend any time trying to relate to unicorns. And the same is true for someone who doesn't believe there's God. You wouldn't spend any time trying to relate to a myth, a fiction, a fantasy, a superstition. And so we would need to answer that question. Is part of modern man's problem, crisis, anxiety, not that he's alienated from himself, or not only that he's alienated from himself, not only that he's alienated from his environment, not only that he's alienated from other humans, or not only that he's alienated from the product of his labor. Those could be factors, but not only those. First and foremost, is he alienated from God? And one of the reasons is because he's either said there is no God, or thought of God more like the first domino that fell over and knocked the rest of the universe into motion. So either there is no God, or God does not see, God does not hear, God is no longer active in the world, if he ever was. And so modern man is not able then to relate to existence anymore. And there may be a few other ways in which God is understood. Like, well, God, modern man thinks of God as the self. The fullest development of myself is the expression of God, which is a lot like what Adam and Eve were told to believe. You can be God. And so modern man's crisis comes in the lack of integrity in putting themselves in the place of God, thinking they could be God. And what's interesting about that is then it's no longer modern man's problem. That's the original problem from the beginning. And so the solution to that existential anxiety is not just overcoming alienation to self, other humans, product of our labor, our environment. It's coming to integrity requires overcoming that alienation from God where we've put ourselves in the place of God. And in doing that, really declare there is no God. Both in two moments, there is a God, it's me, and there isn't a God in the sense of God, the creator who made me. There's the crisis. And as long as that's not brought to consciousness, this rejection of God is repressed, unaware that one's done that. And you could think, no, I've never said that. But your life looks like that. You live as if there is no God, even though you never consciously made a decision. You might have said, I'm kind of an agnostic. I don't know. Consciously, I've said that. But in my volition, in how I live as if there is no God. And so that has to be brought to consciousness. How have you lived? And if you lived as if there is no God, but there is a God, then that's a contradiction. That's a failure to have integrity. Now what do we do about that? Well, we'll have to address it, bring it to consciousness, and address the inconsistency. And that change, in this case, is called repenting of having done that. And I pointed out how Adam and Eve had opportunities to do that same thing. So Kierkegaard, on the fall of man and anxiety and freedom, what we've done is brought it back to our need for integrity. And integrity requires being consistent with what is real. And so if we have not affirmed God the Creator as real, then we won't be able to relate to that aspect of existence. And that will create that conflict in us that we have to bring out as we pursue greater integrity. Thanks for joining me.